Asia, and that's our future and that's our destiny. And China is China, and it's going to be there, and it's going to continue to influence the states around it in the Pacific and in the region. Countries are going to pick up with Belt and Road, and they're going to want the infrastructure that China's providing and promising.
Bruce Haig, thank you so much for your time. Such a pleasure speaking with you. Despite the claim that AUKUS will boost peace and stability in the region, it already seems to be achieving the opposite. China will perceive a heightened presence of a foreign military as a threat, just like any country would, and naturally want to defend itself. Having more British, American, and Australian forces trying to provoke China is only going to escalate things and maybe lead to an arms race or, worse, a military confrontation. The Americans said they would bring peace and stability to the Middle East. Look how that turned out. You know, America and Britain, they just go park fleets of warships, they fly nuclear bombers on Iran's doorstep, or in this case, China's doorstep, and then talk about countering China as if China is the one camped out in the Florida Keys. This is absurd. Just imagine the reaction if China put its warships in the English Channel or off the coast of California. They would lose it. Just look at the response when the Soviet Union put missiles in Cuba in 1962. They're still talking about it to this day. You know, last time I checked, China isn't the one who just pulled out of Afghanistan after occupying it for 20 years. China didn't commit war crimes in Iraq and Libya. China doesn't have 800 military bases around the world. China offers a different economic model, an alternative way of doing things that doesn't involve aggression and imperialism. China's way of doing things is based on agreement and cooperation, and is soon to become the world's largest economic power. Australia has always clung to Uncle Sam's coattails and needs the United States to feel that it can project a certain degree of power. Now, the United Kingdom longs for the old days of its empire. It just wants to appear relevant after Brexit. That's why they formed AUKUS. As for America, after Afghanistan, America needs a new enemy to justify its $740 billion military budget and to keep expanding its empire and ensure corporate profits. And this is the crux of the issue. Capitalists, imperialists, they hate competition. They want to monopolize. They want to assert dominance and control over every market, every situation. And in the great power struggle between the West and China, the West is scared. Not because China actually poses a threat, but because China proposes an alternate way of doing things and is able to rival them through a different model, making theirs look outdated, weak, and obsolete. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا O you who believe, اِسْتَعِينُوا بِالصَّبْرِ وَالصَّلَاةِ
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now let's listen to the speech of Sheikh Jafar Jafar.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather in glorification and remembrance of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala, 11th Imam's letter to Ibn Babaway. Who is the famously known as Ibn Babaway, who is the father of Shaykh As-Saduq. We know Shaykh As-Saduq, Ridwanullahi alayhima, is one of the most prolific scholars that we have, who has left a tremendous legacy that we benefit from till today. And Shaykh As-Saduq was born with the dua of our 12th Imam. You know, the 12th Imam prayed for Ibn Babaway to have two sons, and he said, name them Muhammad and name them Hussein, and Muhammad is the older one, who is Shaykh As-Saduq. But the 11th Imam had already began this communication with Ibn Babaway, his father. I have read this letter many times, personally. I know I have talked about it in a majlis many years back. But I say that I read this letter quite often, because I feel that the Imam alayhi salam is really talking to us, talking to me. And what I find amazing about this letter is that depending on one's mental state, depending on one's environmental circumstances, I find new insight into this letter. And so I thought that based on our current circumstances that we are enduring, let us look at this letter again. The Imam alayhi salam begins this letter by the name of Allah and the glorification of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and by sending salawat upon the Prophet. And he says, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, Walhamdu lillahi rabbil alameen, wal aqibatu lil muttaqeen. That all praise is to Allah, and the end is for the righteous. Wal aqibatu lil muttaqeen. That means the ones who will be successful, the one who will have a successful end, are those who are muttaqeen, right? Wal jannatu lil muwahideen. And paradise is for those who submit to the tawheed of Allah, the oneness of God. Wal naru lil mulhideen. And the hellfire is for those who deny this oneness. Wa fala udwana illa ala al-zalimeen. And there will be no difficulty or hostility or any type of enmity except for those who are zalimeen, oppressors, those who oppress themselves by denying the oneness of God, those who oppress themselves by doing injustice to themselves or to others. وَلَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا اللَّهُ أَحْسَنُ الْخَالِقِينَ وَالصَّلَاةُ عَلَىٰ خَيْرِ خَلْقِهِ مُحَمَّدُ وَعِتْرَتِهِ الطَّاهِرِينَ. And so this was his introduction. And you know, it reminds me of a very famous tradition that says always begin with Bismillah. Always begin with the name of Allah. And this is again not only something important for us to do when we are engaging in an important task, but even when it comes to training our children and training ourselves, start with Bismillah. Start with the name of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and that will add barakah into whatever it is that we are doing. Then the Imam alayhi salam greets Ibn Babaway, and he says very beautiful. He says, "Amma ba'd," after the praise of God and salawat upon the Prophet and his family, he says, "Ya Shaykhi wa Mu'tamadi Abul Hasan Ali ibn al Hussein al Qummi, waffakaka Allahu li mardatihi wa ja'ala min sulbika awladan salihin bi rahmatihi." Ah, this is gorgeous. Right, this is absolutely beautiful. The praise that the Imam alayhi salam gives Ibn Babaway. He says, "Ya Shaykhi, oh my Shaykh, wa mu'tamadi, the one that I trust, the one that I rely upon, ya Abul Hasan, Ali ibn al Hussein al Qummi, waffakaka Allahu li mardatihi. May Allah be satisfied with you. Yeah, may Allah be pleased with you." And this is a dua. Yeah, so this is the Imam alayhi salam saying, "May Allah be pleased with you," and saying, "Ya Allah, be pleased with him." And of course, Allah would be pleased with him, because the Imam would not pray for something that Allah would not answer, right? And so this is a very powerful dua. And again, The dua that our imams make for us are very powerful, right? And pray. I think this is really essential. You know, we have this tradition. I wrote this write-up a week ago or so at the start of Rabiul Akhar, where the Imam alayhi salam, the eighth imam, says to one of his companions that I will pray for you. Yeah, that I will pray for you. And that we pray for you every night. And I think this is really powerful that the Imam of our time prays for us. Let's go back to the introduction again. And then he says to him, وَجَعَلَ مِن سُلْبِكَ أَوْلَادًا صَالِحِينَ بِرَحْمَتِهِ. And may Allah make from your progeny, or give you in your progeny, good children. Again, a dua from the Imam, right? So leaving that up there so we can reflect on it. The Imam prays for us every night. And so ask the Imam to pray for you in what you need. And inshallah, if we are worthy, he will pray for us. And if he prays for us, that dua will be answered, inshallah, right? But coming back to this point, this shows us the amazing status of Ibn Babaway. Al-Qummi, Ridwanullahi alayh. Because the Imam would not give such praise. To call him, Ya Shaykhi wa Mu'tamadi. This is not empty praise, you know. Sometimes when somebody is being honored, for example, we begin to glorify them and praise them, whether it's accurate or not. This is their night, so we praise them. The Imam does not give arbitrary praise. If somebody is going to be praised by the Imam, it is haqqan, it is deserved for that person. And, you know, that gets me thinking, right? That what does the Imam think of us? Subhanallah, right? Like, are we ready for this type of letter from the Imam, where the Imam alayhi salam is going to be honest and truthful and hit the nail on the head about our personalities, our nature? What does the Imam think of us, right? We have grief and difficulty in our lives. Our intensity for the Imam is high. That grief and difficulty passes, our need for the Imam goes. That's not the mark of a Shia. That's not. The mark of a Shia is that their intensity and desire for the Imam is as high in all circumstances. And they are perpetually in a state of sadness, even though they enjoy the world, but they feel there's something missing. This is who a Shia is, you know. And this is what the Imam alayhi salam needs. And I believe that one of the ways in which we can be there is by doing what the Imam has said in this letter. And I pray that we do. This letter has been very impactful in my life, and I pray that we reflect on it. All you have to do is Google 11th Imam's letter to Ibn Babaway, and you will see it.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to the listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, and analysis on the thoughts and speeches of the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Sadiq and Brother Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa
rahmatullah.
Very welcome to the show, Viewpoints. So regarding the speeches of the leader of Iran on the concept of human being, and the we can say the most important speeches that the rahbar gave on the role that the human being might have in today's world, there have been a series of discussions, and we try to get into the different dimensions and angles of the life of the human beings. Now, for today's discussion, we want to talk about a very important topic, with which the today's generation and also today's movement are also very engaged with, and that is freedom. They somehow define it as liberty, but I think freedom is a better term when we are talking about the Islamic one, because liberty might have root in some specific humanism in the Western theology and philosophy, but freedom in Islam might be defined in a different way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There are two things we need to look at in depth when we talk about liberty or freedom, to understand what it is that we're talking about when we talk about freedom or liberty. One is it absolute freedom? Everyone makes their own rules, no restrictions. Or is it just freedom from unjust, unfair, irrational restrictions? The first one, the absolute freedom, no one can really believe in. It doesn't hold up. Some people might profess this, but in practice, you cannot have this, right?
You mean absolute freedom?
Absolute freedom.
That's right.
You cannot have absolute freedom, okay, because you will be restricting other people's freedom.
That's right.
At some point. So the question becomes, how do we define unjust and unfair restrictions to get rid of them? And it needs a value system. In the West, it's based on different philosophies or materialistic worldview.
Liberal capitalism, for example, nowadays, yes, talks about liberty.
Exactly. Right. Okay. Yes. And in Islam, it's based on Tawheed.
Yes.
The second thing that we need to talk about is it external freedom, which is more associated with the word liberty.
That's right.
Being liberated from something external, or is it internal freedom? Internal from our own desires, our own wants, our own negligence, our own ignorance. Which one is it? And because a materialistic worldview is more concerned with the external world, in the West, we see so much emphasis on the first type.
That's right.
And in Islam, we definitely have more emphasis on the second type, on internal freedom. And if you have internal freedom, you might be a prisoner, but you're a free man.
That's right. So you might be, you might not be free in terms of whatever you want to do in terms of the materialistic,
in physical terms,
in physical terms around,
yeah,
yourself, which of course led into so many catastrophes during the history of the Western, philosophy. We'll get to that. But internally, it's a type of freedom that you have. In Arabic, they call it Hurriya, isn't it?
Yes.
You become a whore. You become like a free man. That whether, you know, you be a prison or a small place or not be engaged in any materialistic kind of world, but inside you sense a kind of freedom, which has roots in divinity. Thank you very much, Sheikh Sadiq. Just these two categorizations by you for now?
Yeah, I think these two are very important.
Okay.
Understanding the meaning of freedom.
That's all right.
We start talking about it.
So what about you, Brother Ali? How do you define freedom in terms of the Islamic terms?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. I believe freedom is one of the most oppressed terms in the course of history that actually has been violated, because it is being said that some believe that they are actually believing freedom, but in practice, in reality, they really violate the freedom of themselves and the others. So in order to see what freedom is in an Islamic context and comparing to a Western or let's say humanistic worldview, we need to actually differentiate. We need to focus on these two worldviews. In an humanistic worldview, freedom is defined around the humanism, because the person, the individual, is important and is looked at as the center of the universe and the center of the world.
That's right.
So whatever is going to be defined as freedom actually rounds about the personality of the person, the individual. Whatever is good to him actually is appreciated and is respected, and what is bad for the person actually is rejected. And it is seen as something unrestricted, but in actuality it is restricted, because actually it violates the rights of others, and they come to make an agreement, or what they call it, a law, to define it and to limit it to some certain rules, but and they also actually reach to a way that it says that let's look at the will of the majority of the people in society. What is called as democracy. Again, why I said that even this freedom is being violated, because democracy in the most democratic, let's say, governments, or let's say countries, we see that democracy is not actually the will of the majority of the people. We see that in practice it is the will of, let's say, a limited group of people who are ruling over the others, because those who democratically are elected or selected as the representatives of the people, later on they become those limited number of groups of people who are actually make decisions for the others.
Especially when we take a look at the Western world.
Exactly.
We see that
the capitalistic.
This liberal capitalism has its own problems,
mm-hmm.
which cannot be the same prescription for all the people from all cultures, all around the world with different races and languages. Although I think the elites part of the society, which have their own role in shaping this democracy, have their own problems too. We see it, for example.
Democracy, theoretically, in what is being said or written, is not actually that bad to say that, okay, it can be actually modified to a better, let's say, form. But the most important element which is actually missing in democracy is the role of God.
That's right.
What we can actually vividly see it in the Islamic worldview towards freedom. We say human being is free in the line with Allah's worship and submission to Allah.
That's right.
In a tawhidi or in a tawhidi context.
In a monotheistic context.
So in that we say that human is free, is not actually submissive to anyone in the world, any entity, any actual existence, except God. So which one is more free? The freedom that actually is circling around a person, but it is being defined by different elements, like different other peoples, many different other elements, like people, like groups, like political groups and parties, or the freedom that is being defined around the concept of God. So you mean that you are totally free, but your freedom is on the way, in line with Allah's worship and Allah's submission. So we believe that the freedom that is talked about in Islam is much more wider than the freedom that actually is looked at in the humanistic worldview. And by mystique, they actually claim, or they accuse Muslims or the followers of the Islam, that they have no freedom. But in reality, we see the results.
Not only the Muslims, but all the believers in the world from the other religions, are condemned for not having freedom or not living freely. But this is the life that we made for the people. For example, this is the land
I'm asking,
that we
which
created.
Is more actually restricted? The one whose freedom is being actually restricted by many elements, like this person, that person, this, let's say, capitalistic power, or the other, let's say, materialistic element.
That's right.
Or the one who is just limited to the words of God, or the submission to God. So it means that you are limited only from one side, and this side is good for your own spirituality, for your own existence, for your own tranquility.
And we see
so
that
which one is more beautiful and actually deserves to be thought about?
Especially nowadays, with the role that the media has, we could see what are the consequences of absolute freedom in terms of the materialism in the Western world. You see how much the rate of mass killing of the people. These are absolutely rooted in the freedom seeking of the people inside themselves. You know how much the rate of rape is increasing. You know, the killing of the people, the wars here and there. These are all rooted because of the man-centrism that the people are looking for. But according to what you said, Brother Ali, the true freedom is rooted in a monotheistic Islam. But Sheikh Sadeq, what is this monotheistic look? I mean, if we want to explain it for our dear listeners how the concept of Tawheed and freedom might be connected. How do you define it? How do you explain it?
It's a very good question. I think one of the verses in the Quran that talks about this is overlooked because it's mentioned within a story, the story of Prophet Yusuf.
Mm-hmm.
When the prisoners ask Prophet Yusuf about the meaning of their dreams, Prophet Yusuf first gives them a theology lesson. He asks them this very fundamental question. He asks, أَأَرْبَابُ مُتَفَرِّقُونَ خَيْرٌ أَمِ اللَّهُ الْوَاحِدُ الْقَهَّارُ. Which one is better, having just one God or many gods? And you can see that there is no option for no God.
Okay.
We're always a servant.
Yes.
So the only options are you either have one God or you have many gods.
That's right.
Because we're not gods, right? We're not invincible.
Yes.
We're always in need for different things. We need food. We need security. We need a lot of things.
Yes.
To be able to sustain ourselves. So we either have one God who is our sustainer, who is our Razzaq, or we have many gods. We have our boss, we have our wife, our children,
yes,
our manager, our principal, the bullies in the school.
The statesman.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Our desires, our anger, yes, all of these become gods. And each of these want to take us towards itself, right?
Okay.
So we have many gods or just one God. Which one is better? And, of course, just having one God, one set of rules, gives you more freedom than having many gods that contradict each other, right?
Yes.
So this is the fundamental basis of freedom when we talk about freedom in the context of Tawheed.
That's right.
Right? And this is why, fundamentally, you will never be able to get freedom in any other context,
yes,
other than Tawheed.
You're making
this is why they're
easy,
struggling, yes, in the West,
yeah, yeah,
to define the best way to get to freedom, and they will never succeed.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Sadiq, and Brother Ali, thank you very much for your presence in the program. Viewpoint, it was very kind of you, the concept of freedom and liberty as discussed by the leader of the Islamic Ummah, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. It was very kind of you. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening to us. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, you can visit our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
Aperture. Welcome back to Aperture. Before we follow Javad, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, to the desert regions in South Khorasan province, an area of vast desert, sand dunes, and aridness as far as the eye can see. But amid what looks like arid wasteland, at first are wonderful and amazing surprises, including canyons, freshwater springs, and traces of past civilizations. But perhaps what is even more amazing, the next part of the program, is that this dry, arid land yields the world's most coveted spice and Iran's prized red gold, saffron.
I leave behind the ruins of Dihuk and its beautiful architecture for my main destination, which is the terraced saffron farms of Esfandiar, a patchwork of little farms that demands the attention of any visitor. The name Esfandiar was derived from the word espand, or wild rue plants that grow in abundance in and around this village. In the spring season, these perennial plants make the mountains surrounding Esfandiar all the more beautiful. In my opinion, this village is a masterpiece, home to many and varied beauties in and around it. The people of Esfandiar are kind, faithful, and hardworking. Farming is the main occupation of the people living in this part of the country. And their main produce is Iran's famed red gold, that is, saffron. The fragrant, vivid crimson threads are known by almost everybody around the world and has forever been the world's most expensive spice. In the words of researchers, the history of saffron goes back thousands of years. Iran was the first place where these beautiful flowers were planted. And after Iran's neighboring countries such as India, Syria, and Lebanon found out about it, it was also planted in Greece for the first time. The word zafaran is the Arabicized version of the word zarparan, meaning a flower with petals of gold. Saffron threads are plucked from the flower saffron crocus and used mainly as a seasoning and coloring agent in food. Historically, saffron has been among the most expensive spices in the world. Harvesting saffron is so labor-intensive. Every 150,000 crocus flowers that weigh approximately 75 kilos yields a meager 1 kilo of this sought-after spice. The crocus bulb grows multiple flowers for several years, but after that, the number of its buds decreases by the year. Still, there have been instances where 30-year-old bulbs bloomed too. Around the world, saffron is used as food seasoning, medicine, dyeing agent, and fragrance. At the moment, Iran is the world's biggest producer of saffron, accounting for 90% of the world's production. Saffron has been used as a coloring agent for 50,000 years. Signs of that application have been discovered in drawings found in caves in Iraq and across the Achaemenid Persian Empire. Sumerians used it as medicine and for making certain potions. Iran's South Khorasan province is the main producer of saffron in the country. The reason I've chosen Esfandiar is the many other stunning sights to see apart from the beautiful saffron farms, the beautiful pomegranate, fig, and almond gardens, the lofty mountains behind the village reaching to the skies, the vast terraced saffron farms, and the very hospitable people who are a valuable asset for Iran. Add to that the beautiful ancient village of Esfandiar, that has lain uninhabited for around 30 years for fear of earthquakes. Beauties have turned Isfandiyar into a peerless little paradise in the heart of the desert. I'm overjoyed at the knowledge that the village has maintained its original shape, everything from the architecture to the farmlands. Thanks to my good friend Abbas Amiri, a village council member and a school teacher, and the other responsible inhabitants of the village, no one is allowed to make even the smallest changes to the architecture of the buildings in the village and of those nearby. I hope that the authorities of the Cultural Heritage Organization and the responsible villagers living here will join forces in preserving and renovating the unique architecture of the buildings in Isfandiyar, give local and foreign tourists a chance to relish in such a beautiful bucolic environment, and leave a precious legacy for posterity. Additionally, a move like that will help the country's tourism industry to thrive and create jobs for the locals, provided that not a single modern structure is built in this area, and the landscape is clear of paved roads, power posts, and other eyesores. I spend the whole day walking around in the mountains surrounding Isfandiyar and taking beautiful photos of the village from different angles. I'm supposed to accompany my good friend Amir, a village council member and high school teacher, and his kindly wife to a saffron farm. I want to see up close how they and other villagers pick the saffron threads. It's freezing. It's 6:30 in the morning and most of the villagers have already sat down in a squatting position on their farms picking saffron-bearing flowers. I really didn't want to get out of my comfortable bed and come out here in this biting cold and dry weather. But the best time to pick those flowers and to see the farmers at work is the very early cold hours of morning. Apparently, it has to be cold, and it should still be dark when they start picking the flowers. I better get going. Very cold, very. It is mid-fall, and the best time to harvest the saffron. The cold, early morning fall weather in the desert is ice cold. Time is of the essence for these saffron farmers, so they have to make the best use of the time they have. From the day when the first saffron crocuses burst into flower, the farmers have around 15 days to pick all of them. Therefore, they cannot wake up anytime they want and go to work anytime they please. There is a certain time during all those 15 days at which the farmers can pick the flowers, and that is only the early morning hours. All the villagers, men and women, young and old, lend a helping hand on the farm during this period. It takes a certain degree of skill to pick the flowers, and the older folks of Isfandiyar are master pickers, hands down. If you leave those flowers under the sun for too long after they have bloomed, your saffron is going to lose most of its original aroma and taste. It diminishes the quality of your saffron, as if the aroma of the saffron gets released into the air and disappears forever. That's what I'm told. You have to pick the buds with the longest stems, and you have to do it fast. There is no alternative to the human hand when it comes to picking these flowers. No machines, no automatons, no nothing. The men and women of the village spend hours squatting or doubling down while picking the flowers. The cold weather and the time crunch on the one hand, and the pressure on the farmers' knees and backs on the other, make the job ever more difficult. The tips of the fingers tingle from the bitter cold, and nagging pain starts to be felt in the knees and back. The work is agonizing and toilsome. Desert dwellers are tough human beings, and do not easily give up in the face of the difficulties presented to them by life. These people's entire being is made up of hope and love of life. They are eternally grateful to God, even when doing the most difficult of work. The young people, too, hum local songs as they work. After spending only a couple of hours with Amir and his family on their farm, I'm completely worn out. The pain in my back and knees is excruciating, but I feel great, because during those 3 hours, I got to see firsthand what these hard-working people go through. I can feel their pain. But there's something that upsets me and all of Iran's saffron farmers. Unfortunately, the farmers do the lion's share of the work in producing saffron. A case in point is the back-breaking harvesting process, but it's the middleman who stands to make most of the profit. That's an issue that calls for proper management and careful planning. The farmers need help to cash in on the result of their hard work, to make a profit that makes it all worth their while. Another big problem is a lack of proper, internationally interesting packaging industry in Iran for exporting saffron. A country like Spain is making the best of this opportunity. It buys Iran's high-quality saffron at a very low price, puts it in beautiful, modern packaging, and re-exports it to other countries in its own name and at a much higher price. The margin of profit is staggering, and that's what the farmers here have been complaining about. I am depressed after watching the farmers work so hard and hearing out their problems, but Amir has a present for me to cheer me up. To refresh themselves and shake off the cold after the working hours, the farmers get together somewhere next to their farms and brew themselves some fresh tea laced with fresh saffron in a pot on fire made from dry sticks. Locals here believe that saffron tea cheers you up. It makes you laugh. It helps freshen you up. But for someone like me, the question that comes to mind is, how can you not be happy when you hang around with such hardworking, kind, pure souls? How can you sit down with these folks, sip saffron tea with them, and not be filled with joy? The fact is that even without this tea, saffron tea I mean, you get filled with peace and happiness when you hang around with people who spend all day from morning till evening doing back-breaking work. Cheers. After imbibing that delicious saffron-flavored tea one sip at a time, I decide to sit down with one of the elders of Esfandiar, and that is none other than Mr. Danai. He tells me about the desert people's frugal existence, about their simple lifestyle, about the tough days of famine many years ago, and the perseverance and resilience of his fellow villagers in the face of the vicissitudes of life. The farmers don't have any time to waste. Therefore, after picking the flowers, they usually sit down together and start the next phase of saffron production, which is plucking the stigmas from the flowers. That's why I believe those who live in deserts or near them are very patient people. See for yourself. Take a look around. It took a lot of patience for them to turn this steep surface into a terraced farmland. Then, with a lot of hardship, they planted the saffron bulbs in it, spent months attending to them and waiting for them to yield. As far as I know, saffron crocuses bloom once a year. It takes a lot of elbow grease to cultivate them. They don't need much water, but still growing them is no walk in the park. Everything about saffron requires a lot of hard work and patience. That's why I've come to believe that desert dwellers are very stoic. Whatever they do calls for a lot of patience, and if they aren't patient, things won't happen. They won't prosper. The pain Mr. Amiri has in his knees and back is a pain that everybody here shares. All these people work really hard on these farms. And as I say, those living in desert climates are super patient human beings. Being in their company gives you the kind of peace that defies description. The last stage in the production of saffron involves spreading the stigmas on a proper surface and leaving them to dry. And that's a job that has to be done with a lot of care and skill. Otherwise, the quality of the end product will be impacted. In the end, the middlemen come to the villages, buy the dried saffron from the farmers, and sell it at staggering prices after proper packaging. I have high hopes for this beautiful village to be reconstructed and renovated. I hope that on my next trip to Esfandiar, I see many tourists here. There aren't many places on Earth that share the same natural, architectural, agricultural, and anthropological variety as Esfandiar's. But unfortunately, those beautiful houses you see behind me, although they used to be people's homes one day, now lay in ruins. No one is paying adequate attention to all the historical, cultural, and architectural beauties of our beloved country. I'm sure each one of those houses in this beautiful mountainous region, with all these vast terraced saffron farms and its beautiful gardens, not to mention its very hospitable residents, I'm sure if they are renovated, they can act as hotels in this region to accommodate tourists coming from other countries and, of course, local tourists traveling to this region. They can become beautiful hotels offering peaceful moments to those staying at them. My trip to South Khorasan has come to an end. I'm leaving with beautiful memories and valuable knowledge of this region of Iran. Before setting out for this part of the country from the capital city, I wouldn't even dream of such spectacular scenery and such kind human beings. I traveled to this area to see the saffron crocuses growing in the desert. I found the beauties of South Khorasan as a treasure trove, each of which is as beautiful as Iran's famed saffron. All this area needs to turn it into a major tourist attraction is proper attention and management on the part of government officials. And all that is possible if the traditional lifestyle of the folks living here does not undergo any radical changes, and provided the untouched scenery in these areas is not despoiled by modern residential and industrial structures. The beautiful face of deserts and the wilderness, the sand dunes and mountains, the animal and plant species living in deserts, an unpolluted blue sky, clean air, beautiful, vacant yet livable villages, the farms and gardens of the area, and on top of them all, the genuine and hospitable people with a rich culture. Each and every one of them is as precious as the saffron produced in the desert of South Khorasan. All I wish for is for all these assets to be preserved and protected for future generations.
Well, perhaps next time you enjoy another Persian dish with the exquisite scent of saffron, you will remember the terraced saffron farms of Isfandiar and the kind and hard-working farmers who plant the little purple flowers and harvest strands of red gold. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture for another documentary. Goodbye for now.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of The Lantern. Wherever you are, I hope you are in a great state of health, wealth, and spirituality. Your heart is filled with content, peace, and submission to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and His decree, and your day is going wonderfully. Islam constantly encourages us to do our best. Not just regarding spiritual matters, not just regarding arriving at our divine purpose, ultimate objective, you know, reason for creation, which are, you know, really important things, but do our best regarding everything. Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam was the CEO, grandmaster, of putting his utmost effort and attention toward any task at hand. Let's listen to a short story. It's a beautiful one. And we're going to be right back with more discussions regarding stuff. Stay with us.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah. Dear friends, salamu alaikum. So welcome to this episode of Lantern. As usual, we have an interesting story at the beginning of our program. On a warm summer at a beautiful beach, a little boy on his knees scoops and packs the sand with plastic shovels into a bucket. He upends the bucket on the surface and lifts it. And to the delight of the little architect, the castle tower is created. He works all afternoon spooning out the moat, packing the walls, building sentries with bottle tops, and bridges with popsicle sticks. With his hours of hard work on the beach, a sand castle will be built. In a big city with busy streets and rumbling traffic, a man works in an office. He shuffles papers into stacks, delegates assignment, cradles the phone on his shoulder, and punches the keyboard with his finger. He juggles with numbers, contracts get signed, and much to delight of the man, a profit is made. And all his life he will work, formulating the plans and forecasting the future. His annuities will be sentries, and capital gains will be bridges. An empire will be built. The two builders of the two castles have very much in common. They both shape granules into grandeurs. They both make something beautiful out of nothing. They both are very diligent and determined to build their world. And for both, the tide will rise and the end will come. Yet that is where the similarities cease. For the little boy sees the end of his castle while the man ignores it. As the waves approach, the child jumps to his feet and begin to clap as the waves wash away his masterpiece. There is no sorrow, no fear, no regret. He is not surprised. He knew this would happen. He smiles, picks up his tools, and takes his father's hand and goes home. The man in the sophisticated office is not very wise like the child. As the wave of years collapses on his empire, is terrified. He hovers over the sandy monument to protect it. He tries to block the waves with the walls he made. He snarls at the incoming tide. "It's my castle," he defies. The ocean responds. Both know to whom the sand belongs.
The lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
The thing about life is, sure, we're meant to put our full effort into perfecting, into mastering, into getting the best results out of it. But it's so fleeting. It's not going to last. And it's not our ultimate purpose. And if we indulge in it too much, allowing ourselves to get attached and become owned by those material things, then once that wave washes up to the shore of our lives, crashes against our castle, our mansion, our position, our degree, all the material objects that we've hoarded throughout the years. And that wave is going to come sooner or later. We're going to be devastated. There's a hadith someone asked Imam al-Hasan al-Mujtaba alayhi salam, that why do people despise death and love life? And His Eminence said that it's because you've destroyed your hereafter. You've destroyed your home, your eternal home that comes after death. And you've spent too much time and energy, all your time and energy, in building your home in this world. Naturally, no one would like to leave a beautiful mansion to go live in ruins forever. There has to be a balance. This is where Inna Lillah wa Inna Ilayhi Raji'un comes in. It's sad that every time the sentence is said, we only think about, ooh, who died? We forget that you are going to die. I don't want to make this sound gloomy or depressing, but Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam does say that remembrance of death is the solution to every problem, because you are reminded that this isn't permanent. Nothing about it is. It's not gonna last. It and you and everything in between, before and after your existence, will return to Allah. And once you return to Allah, will you be able to say, remember that castle I built for myself on this world? I housed, hosted, catered to so many needy people. I fed so many stomachs in that castle you blessed me with. I gave shelter to so many orphans. I used its facilities for the youth, for the majalis of the remembrance of the Ahlul Bayt, as a reforming center for people who are struggling, to help them, rehabilitate them. Remember all that money you gave me in that world? I shared it, Ya Allah, I shared it as much as I could. And then you kept giving me more. We have to be careful. We have to be careful the most of what we're sending forth. What are our baqiyat as-salihat? That should be the result. That should be the objective of every material thing we put time, effort, and energy into. Every material thing we try to perfect in this world should be done with the intention of it lasting us forever in the eternal abode. And that is only